very much to all the volunteers who've been involved with the Backpack Coalition. And I want to thank Zubair for the vision he had to focus UUCS on one service project this year. Especially in this transition time, I think it was a really great idea and it made a real difference in our community. And I saw in our literature we collected $4,000 for the Backpack Coalition. And as has just been stated, our children have been packing lunches most Sundays. Sometimes the school doesn't need the bags. And they're going to be getting a pizza party on the fifth Sunday of this month. So we are truly trying to teach our children how to be of service to others in the world. And I want to thank Heather Suri, Stephanie Roach, Ben Friedson and his family, who packed numerous bags, and also want to thank Rachel Roman. You've all done such a wonderful job this year. And Doreen DeConte, who've really made a difference in the lives of children in Loudoun County. Now I want to go on to something a little bit tougher. So I'm going to segue into this. Poor people are bad people, violent people, criminal lawbreakers, welfare queens, affirmative action babies. Rich people are good, vulnerable, invulnerable, nice, benevolent. Poor people need to repay all of what they've been given. They shouldn't really be on a college campus. They shouldn't really get good things in this life. Rich people have privilege. These are the messages we get from our media that demonize poor people. And it is the greatest sin of American culture that you will be condemned if you ask for help. And no one gets through this life without asking for help, without receiving something, and then also giving back. And in my experience with social justice projects I've worked with UU, I've seen people, and in other places, I've seen people who have benefited from various projects give back in innumerable ways, through their careers, through the new opportunities they've been given. I need to take another breath. Because I didn't mean what I just said. These are binaries. These are attitudes, again, that affect us from the media on a daily basis on various levels. I've heard some people say, you know, what if you didn't have the boots to pull yourself up? What if you didn't have, you know, you got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But what if you didn't have bootstraps to pull yourself up by? Yes. Hunger in Loudoun County and across Northern Virginia and the DC region is not something we think about when we live in an affluent county. Most people don't worry about where the next meal is coming from. And I'm sure some people in this congregation have had to ask for help in the past. They might be asking for help now, and they might have to ask for help in the future. These are strengths, not weaknesses. And we're all here for each other. And I agree with Marion Wright Edelman and Shirley Chisholm when they say that service is the debt you pay for living. Loudoun County has a median income of $112,000, and there's an estimated 10,000 food insecure children in Loudoun County. I believe food insecurity is a symptom of the lack of affordable housing, especially because people, as we heard, will skimp on the most flexible thing we have, which is our food and how we take care of ourselves. The median rent is $101,724. And a lot of people spend about half their income on their housing. And rising costs put children and their families at risk. And the Loudoun Hunger Relief Project provides about 3 days worth of food to 60 to 90 families each Saturday. And the Backpack Coalition serves children and families with pantry-style meals on a weekly basis that provide helps them on the days when they're not at school. And these are very wonderful efforts. But I also, in the future, would like to see UCS be part of relationship building and getting out into the community and getting to know people who are, struggling to make a difference in their own lives and in the lives of others. Right now, we're in a transition period, and I think in the future we're going to be trying to figure out with the new minister where we want to go with social justice. And my prayer is that we move beyond these walls, and that we bring our love into the world, because service is the love we show in public.
Social justice activities are quite simply the way we get from the world as it is to the world we dream about. Justice, social justice, doing justice work, love in action, I use those words often. We use those words in our children's religious education program. I use those words in the context of anti-racism work, restorative justice work in our educational and criminal systems, about Me Too, about fair wages, and about saving our planet. You could use them about immigration or guns or whatever moves you. So in this homily, I may use an example of immigrant sanctuary, but please insert your own most pressing social justice issue into my words as you hear them, and listen with that ear. What do I mean by social justice? I want to make it clear, I mean four different things, and congregations and individuals can get stuck in any of those four, maybe two of the four. So let's go down the list. First, self-education. That is important. That is how we learn about the injustices of our world and figure out what we want to change. Wonderful books like The New Jim Crow, which was studied here, or Between the World and Me, maybe a potent and or maybe even a novel, could help us figure out what's going on and change us. Yes, UUs are often good at self-education. But since education doesn't confuse with the other three, I'm just going to put it aside. I honor it, and I'm going to put it aside for now, because the other three types of social justice work can get jumbled in people's mind. So there's charity, there's public witness, and there's interpersonal work. We've learned from Sharon and Kelly about some of the good charity work that this congregation is doing. We give money and food to the Backpack Coalition. We raise money each year on Christmas Eve for Beacon House, a center for educating kids and giving them after-school programs in D.C. We donate scarves and gloves and hats to laws. Many of us give generously to victims of hurricanes or floods. It is important, and I urge you to give and give generously to the causes that touch your heart. I know you all well enough to know that you do give charitably to the causes on your list. This is useful. Money is needed. Financial generosity keeps so many valuable institutions going. Yes to financial generosity and charity, oh, and pledge campaigns. Yes to financial generosity. But let us not confuse that with the other two types of social justice work. Let me now talk about public witness. When you write your legislator, canvass for a cause you believe in, show up at a rally, or do phone banking on behalf of a candidate or legislation you believe in, those are examples of public witness. I do all of those things, and probably many of you do too. You tend to be people who show up. Some people believe that public witness is political. If you do public witness for a candidate or a party, I guess so. But there is nothing, let me repeat, nothing political about taking a stand on the issues of the day. Thursday, I'm going to the Supreme Court to rally with another congregation on the subject of gerrymandering. Gerrymandering has nothing to do with taking a stand on a political issue. It's simply something that we've got to change to let democracy work. That is living into our values, and that is part of who we are as a denomination, public witness. Now, the last type of social justice work is the least understood, and it often seems the least undertaken in our congregations. Sharon mentioned this earlier. This type of activism is deeply relational. It is human at its core. It is not about money. It is not about showing up in public. It is about getting to know people and serving them and working with them through human relationships. When I spoke earlier today about showing up at the All Area Muslim Society, the ADAMS, recognition of the victims of the mass shooting in New Zealand, that was relational work. The imam and I had never met, but he knew of this congregation because of your former minister's work, and he greeted me as a colleague and a friend and a supporter. That is the type of thing that relational work lets us do. That's relational work. Or last summer, I was fortunate enough to be invited to attend the Industrial Areas Foundation 10-day training. It's an organization that is devoted to training community organizers. You may have heard of them. Barack Obama was one of their organizers. For those who don't know of it, IAF is the premier community organizing group in the nation. They bring together congregations and their congregants. So it's not a personal level activity, it's a congregational level activity to demand changes their members need in our political and institutional priorities. In Montgomery County, where I live, it has a different name, but here in Virginia, the IAF organization is Voice for Virginians Organized for Interfaith Community Engagement. The goal of Voice, and indeed all of the Industrial Areas Foundation organizations, they call them subsidiaries, I think, is to bring people together across religious, racial, ethnic, economic, and political affiliations to build a stronger Northern Virginia. Every word in that sentence was important. It works across racial, religious, ethnic, and political party affiliations. That is why it is called broad community organizing. It works to build a stronger locality, and mostly it brings people together. IAF work is about relationships and getting to know each other, so we actually push towards change that is relevant to people's lives. Not what we think is important, but what those who need a change think is important. So let me give you an example from my time in Maryland. While I was working in Maryland, the Metro Transit Union was getting involved with the local affiliate of the IAF. When I went to that first meeting with the local Metro workers, I thought I knew what their issues were, right? Now, smart person, I know that they want job security, benefits, maybe wages would have been their central issue. I think I knew it. Instead of going into that meeting with my notions front and center in my head, however, I used a little self-discipline. Thank goodness I did not let them know what they needed. I went as a listener. I heard concerns that I would not have imagined. For instance, as you may know, Metro serves many, many jurisdictions in our area and has to follow the laws in each. So every time they, you know, cross a street, they may be in a new jurisdiction with different laws. DC uses Metro buses for most student transportation. Anyway, the bus drivers I was listening to were talking about the fact that every jurisdiction had different rules for when kids ride free or road subsidized. Some programs started after school let out, some were all day. Some ended at 5, some ended at 6. Some were subsidized fully, some were partially subsidized. In short, the complexities of letting kids get their rides as they were entitled to was incredibly complex. And it took too much time and energy for the drivers. The drivers wanted, they requested a unified pass or perhaps two passes that let them place, give the kids the right charge or no charge in a fast, dare I say it, friendly way. Rather than getting into tussles with each kid who says, no, I'm Frederick, I'm Fairfax, I'm this, I'm that. Wow. I had to listen hard to understand that issue. And doesn't it make sense? A driver looks at a pass and doesn't see what the kid thinks they are showing, and now there's a fracas. I understand this easily resolvable tension in the driver's work days. Understanding the issue was part of getting to know the Metro workers whose jobs weren't like mine, who actually had a critical perspective on this issue. Supporting Metro workers in their demand that these passes be simplified made a lot of sense once I got it. And I got it through relationship and listening. Then we rallied to help the Metro workers to get that sort of change to happen. And it hasn't happened yet. Maybe it will or maybe it won't. But what I do know is that those workers who told me and others about this need felt heard. They knew someone listened and tried to support what they wanted, not what we thought they wanted. I subscribe to the New York Times. They have a standing feature named the Neediest Cases Fund. I don't know about you, but that name, the Neediest Cases Fund, is absolutely repellent to me. People have needs, sure. It's great that the New York Times has a facilitative way of raising money for people with needs. But the name could use revision. A person isn't a case, they are a person with needs. The worst cases, and even the neediest, dehumanizes the people that they are raising money for. Have you heard the word other to describe a way of talking or thinking about someone that makes them very different from you, that labels them as so different? That is what the Neediest Cases Fund that the Times does. It others the people who need help. You can do better than the New York Times. And a few years ago, this congregation saw a person, not a case, just a person, when you worked closely with Fairfax U to adopt Marzia Popple. She came with her two children as part of the Refugee Resettlement Project, and as a community, you provided for this family's needs. That wasn't charity. It may have had a touch of public witness to us. I wasn't here then, but mostly it was relational, interpersonal, about getting to know Marzia and her family. You provided support such as English lessons. Okay, how many of you helped provide English lessons for this family? I'm thinking some hands are gonna go up. Okay. I bet doing face-to-face activities with this family would feel different than writing a check to support her. I'm just guessing. I know when I babysat for a refugee family many years ago, trying to read English kids' books to the kids in my mediocre Spanish, that felt different to me than when I read a check. In my case, it even involved a birthday cake. The most radical thing you can do is build relationships. I'm going to say it again. The most radical thing you can do is build relationships. Right now in our sister congregation at Cedar Lane in Maryland, they are housing an undocumented refugee. Rosa lives in the old parsonage. She needs to have someone with her 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. If she is not accompanied by someone, then she may be arrested and deported. But as long as there is somebody there with her, if any ICE agent comes to talk with her, sanctuary can be claimed on her behalf by the other person. Might you want to help? The name of the contact person is in your order of service. Last, I'd like to present a concept or a circle, draw the circle wide, or a flow of activities that could move between these types of justice work. I've seen congregations get stuck. I've seen somebody say, we should learn, no, we should do, we should, where's the or? Like, no, and, we should learn, we should do, we should give public witness. So let's say that a new issue emerges. I don't know what that issue is for you. You educate yourself about it. You become convinced that you can do something. Then you give some money. Then you enter into a relationship with someone tied to that cause. Finally, as in the case of Voice or other industrial area foundation work, you decide you are going to write letters, show up for rallies, make your commitment to those personal relationships visible in the world. That is a cycle of justice collaboration that you can jump on at any point. That profound cycle is, in my opinion, the way that change happens. On the cover of your order of service, I had printed Shirley Chisholm's words, or were they Mario Wright Edelman's words? Sharon and I went back and forth on that a little bit. Service is the rent we pay for the privilege of living on this earth. Whoever said it, it was right. This church does so much service. One of the great opportunities of the interim years is that you have the opportunity to reflect together about all of the ways that you live out your ministry as individuals and in a community. Radical hospitality, stewardship, fellowship, small groups, charity, public witness, and relational justice work. Every type of justice work is available to you here. Every aspect of your life together in faith will be passed through a lens of discernment. Is this a genuine expression of who we understand ourselves to be? Does this further our mission? Does it emerge out of our covenant? I believe that continued reflection will move this congregation past its current focus on charity and into an expanded focus on witness and relational work. Maybe our task starts with education and moves on to charity, giving money to a refugee family. Sometime, I predict some of you are going to feel the need to publicly address through letters, calls, and more, to publicly witness what needs to change in our world. And finally, there is the possibility of relational social justice work through Voice, working with Adams, working with Cedar Lane, in new ways and in places unknown. This virtuous cycle of education to charity to relational work, public witness is yours. Shirley Chisholm was right. Blessed be.
A record of your presence.